from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In 1971, Daniel Ellsberg leaked top-secret Defense Department documents about the U.S. military and political involvement in the Vietnam War. A military analyst at the time, Daniel Ellsberg was charged as a spy, but the case was later dismissed. He'll join us in studio to discuss his new memoir, The Doomsday Machine, an eyewitness account of the biggest threat to our survival, an ongoing dangerous nuclear weapons strategy, and how we can avoid nuclear catastrophe. It's coming up next. Stay with us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Former military strategist Daniel Ellsberg, famous for releasing the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret study of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, calls the United States' nuclear weapons policy dizzyingly insane and immoral. In his new memoir, Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, Daniel Ellsberg chronicles his years spent as a nuclear policy analyst, which included the near miss of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And he joins us this hour to discuss his new book and why he calls for more risk reduction measures around nuclear weapons. We'll also get his thoughts on the new movie The Post, which dramatizes the Washington Post's decision to publish the Pentagon Papers back in 1971. And Dan Ellsberg, welcome back to Forum. Good to have you.
Very good to be here. Thank you.
This is, let me begin with kind of a mystery that I found. You did a lot of copying, as everybody knows who knows the story of the Pentagon Papers. There was copying of some 7,000 pages, but there was a safe that you put about 15,000 pages into and that wound up at your brother's place. And this is all the stuff that you've revealed in here about, well, nuclear planning. Why 45 years before this has come out?
Really, there was no interest I found in publishing this earlier, 45 years ago, without the documents. And the documents had unfortunately been lost. I gave them to my brother for safekeeping to come out when the Pentagon Papers had had their effect on the Vietnam War as much as they could. I then expected to put these papers out. He put them in a trash hump, a trash deep. Can't say this right, a trash dump, how's that, in Tarrytown, New York, where it was hit by a hurricane and scattered irretrievably. So I was not able to get the documents. Without those documents, many of which, by the way, have been declassified now with the National Security Archive and others under Freedom of Information Act, they now are largely available and yet have drawn very little attention over the last 20 years. Prior to that, though, I found very little interest among publishers in trying to get this out. So I spent my time trying to build an anti-nuclear movement that would be comparable to the anti-war movement, and with some success during the bilateral freeze campaign, for example, which tried to get the U.S. and the Soviets to commit to no more weapons, to freezing their weapons programs. And yet when the Cold War ended at the end of the 80s, people thought the problem had gone away. And indeed the rationale, such as it was, which was very bad, but the rationale for having these thousands of weapons went away, but the weapons themselves didn't.
Well, there was an 80% reduction, though.
There has been an 80% reduction, which would seem very significant, but isn't. We had so many excessive weapons, and actually that's an important empirical question to ask, just how many is excessive. But the fact that we had 37,000 weapons in 1967, and the Russians had more than another 30,000 or 40,000, meant that you had so many weapons that to reduce them even by 80% or 90% would make and has made no difference in the risk facing the world.
Well, the risk is exacerbated now by North Korea and by other countries. Israel holds weapons. Pakistan holds weapons. I mean, if anything, you've got even a more dire situation. And one comes away from your book with realizing once again, as I did when I read Eric Schlosser's book, just how dire the situation is. I want to talk about that, but I also want to talk about some ways of perhaps mitigating some of the problems that you suggest. One wonders what happened to the nuclear freeze movement, but it would be good to get it in action again in some fashion. But I wanted to just talk about this catastrophe that's waiting to happen on a scale that's unimaginable. I mean, I think a lot of people just don't get it because we've been living in this mad world of mutual assured destruction, and they don't realize how easily we could fall into nuclear catastrophe, or how now with North Korea, things are really very fragile, to put it mildly.
Well, you've defined the situation very well. I would say it's urgent to change the situation, but it's urgent in the way that it was urgent to increase the levees height in New Orleans, and that just didn't happen. The Katrina Cat 5 hurricane hit in August of 2005. Well, it wasn't just urgent in July. In fact, it was virtually too late at that point. It had been urgent the year before and the year before and the year before, even though we hadn't had such a hurricane. And so when it happened, finally, the levees did break as well as being overflown. Same in Houston. It didn't just become urgent to stop building in flood areas a month before Hurricane Harvey hit. That should have happened years earlier. In that same sense, it's urgent to eliminate the possibility that has existed for actually over half a century, and that is that either the U.S. or the Russia alone, let alone together, could cause fires in cities that would loft smoke into the atmosphere and into the stratosphere where it wouldn't burn out and where it would surround the globe, killing harvests, lowering temperatures to ice age temperatures, winter temperatures in summer, kill the harvests, and lead to the starvation of nearly everyone. Not full extinction, just near extinction.
As you point out in your book, we didn't even know about nuclear winter until the 1980s, but you had all these. What's most shocking here is that we've had all these plans that have existed since Eisenhower's presidency and that continue. And perhaps the most shocking thing here is that there's been a continuity of this in delegating more and more.
That's right. Eisenhower himself, one of the secrets that I describe in this book, which is in a sense no longer secret because the documents have been available now for some 20 years or so, and yet hardly anybody seems aware when I bring it out what I told McGeorge Bundy, the assistant to President Kennedy, back in 1961, a long time ago, and that was, and he didn't know it at that point, that President Eisenhower had delegated authority to use nuclear weapons on their own initiative to his field commanders, his theater commanders, in case communications were out or if there was on another urgent attack that they felt there wasn't time to consult with, they could go ahead. And they had in turn delegated that to lower commanders. I knew that was true in the Pacific in any case, and it was true elsewhere. In other words, as of Eisenhower and ever since, there was not just one finger on the button. People worry about, does Donald Trump have his finger on the button? And the answer is, metaphorically, yes. But not only Donald Trump. How many people could actually believe themselves authorized with communications out or some difficulty to launch this weapon? Or how many could get it launched under their command with or without authority? And the answer is probably no president has ever really known that.
Talking to Daniel Ellsberg, and let me remind you that he has a new book out called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. That goes all the way back to Herman Kahn, your title, right?
Yes, Kahn invented the notion of what he called a doomsday machine, which would be a device that, if triggered by a prearranged set of provocations of some sort, either a nuclear attack or something else, if you programmed it into the computer, would destroy all life on Earth. And the only reason for considering such a thing...
I should mention Herman Kahn worked for RAND, which you worked for, and was a futurist.
He was a brilliant, very fat, very brilliant, very fat physicist who was very imaginative, except that his imagination failed on this point. Having devised the notion of a system that would destroy all life on Earth, he said, but no one would ever actually build this system. You know, it kills too many people. It's too automatic. It doesn't exist and never would exist. He was wrong. It did exist right then, and it had existed for 10 years, actually since Truman. It was on Truman's day that we had 1,000 nuclear weapons targeted mostly on Soviet cities. And the smoke from those cities would have caused nuclear winter, although no one knew it. The 1,000 weapons that Truman left to Eisenhower as a legacy were 23,000 by the time Kennedy came in under Eisenhower. Up from 1,000 to 23,000. As I said, they later rose to 37,000. we have here a mad system, a system that threatened a mad, insane act.
Well, in fact, you point out in the book, when people talk about deterrence was never necessarily part of the whole picture. It was first strike early on. What are we going to do about our enemies?
Deterrence of nuclear attack was not at the beginning. After all, we had a monopoly of nuclear weapons when these plans were first made in the late 40s.
Right.
And the possibility of nuclear retaliation didn't exist, or first strike. But when the Soviets did get nuclear weapons, and especially from the, let's move ahead to the mid-60s, when NATO was still threatening to initiate nuclear war, they were threatening, in the case of a Soviet takeover, say, of Berlin, or move into West Germany, or an uprising in the East in which NATO became involved. In any of those circumstances, the U.S. would initiate strategic nuclear attacks. That plan assured Soviet retaliation that would, even without nuclear winter, would have annihilated our allies. Europe would have been totally sacrificed, like destroying the village in order to save it. And that was the nature of our plans. Nixon called his strategy of threatening nuclear war in Vietnam a madman strategy, the threat of a mad action, that he might be so committed that he might actually do it. And that's being imitated to some extent by Donald Trump right now. But the fact is that NATO planning has always been the threat of a mad act. It's always assumed a mad willingness to see Eurasia, the Northern Hemisphere, go, and the reality, if we initiated and carried out our plans, and in reality, the Southern Hemisphere would have gone too.
You also say that the argument has been presented that since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there's been no nuclear weapons used by the United States. But you make the analogy to guns and say our guns have been pointed and they've been used threateningly. And not only that, but I mentioned Eric Schlosser's book in this context, too. There's a whole sense of what could happen surely by accident or false alarm or unauthorized launching. We've been very lucky, really. I mean, in fact, you point out in your book, Cuba was much worse. The missile crisis probably the most Americans even know.
Yes. I, at the time, being 31 years old and working on that for the executive committee of the National Security Council at a staff level, I thought there was very little risk because Khrushchev was so outgunned in terms of nuclear weapons. We knew by that time that we had an enormous superiority over him. I didn't know that in early 61, but by 62 we did. I thought he had to back down. I was young enough, just out of the Marine Corps, but a peacetime Marine Corps for me in the 50s. I had the belief that someone who was clearly outgunned had to back down, more or less. And I learned better in Vietnam. Neither side backed down, of course. But that went on only 10 years, essentially. In Afghanistan, we're in a 16-year war, which hadn't been envisioned then. But in Cuba, looking back on it, was a case where, in fact, Khrushchev did intend to back down, we now know, rather than go to war. And I believe, after studying this now for 40 years, that Kennedy intended to back down rather than to go to war, that he did not intend to carry out his threats. In effect, both were bluffing, and yet they were deploying weapons, they were exercising, they were delegating, the actions were being taken that came within a hair's breadth of blowing the world up, even though neither side had intended it.
Berlin was much more dangerous too, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
Berlin was much more dangerous as well.
Yes, Berlin. There was a case in the fall of 1961, actually, where tanks were facing each other near Checkpoint Charlie over a confrontation in Berlin at the meeting point between East and West Berlin. And if someone had fired accidentally, as may have happened at Kent State, for example, later, just to throw in a historical episode here, but we don't know whether there was an order there or not, or whether there would have been an order in Berlin. But if somebody had overstepped the bounds and gotten started then, again, we would not be here, because the effects of such a war in Berlin or Cuba would have been to end civilization and most of the human species.
Talking with Daniel Ellsberg, a national security expert, former Pentagon analyst. His new book is The Doomsday Machine: Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, and he'll be appearing on the 18th at City Lights Books at 6:30, and January 1st he'll appear at, February 1st, excuse me, he'll appear at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley at 7:30 p.m. This is also, I want to talk to you about what can be done, because it's an important part of your vision in this book, but This book is a memoir, too, and you begin with a chapter called How Could I? Often asked that question, how can you be a nuclear planner? It kind of boils down to, I mean, you were sort of a kid in Detroit who was very sensitive to the possibility of what could happen from bombing at an early age. But you really were a cold warrior. I mean, you saw Stalin as being like Hitler and you saw Russia as being like the Nazis.
Well, Stalin was like Hitler in certain respects. In his domestic policies, he was as ruthless as Hitler, and his body count was comparable, if not even higher, than Hitler.
And it was his own people. As many
that was his own people, yeah. And it was tyrannical. He was as tyrannical as Hitler could be. So that part of the analogy seemed to fit. What was mistaken was to imagine that he had the reckless determination to expand that Hitler did have. Hitler did exist. But we haven't actually seen in top of a great power or even a relatively minor power in the years since someone as willing to take risks in order to expand territory militarily as Hitler. However, it was convenient to imagine that what we were facing was Hitler because it justified an enormous military buildup on this part, which had various advantages, especially for the people who were building the weapons, and that's still true. Profits, jobs, opportunity, and in the Western Alliance, it gave us a role in Europe that we wouldn't have had otherwise in determining the nature of their countries, in moving against left regimes, in fact, which were supposedly too weak on communism. And it was convenient for us to imagine that what we were facing was the kind of enemy that justified anything. That was the convenience of Hitler as an enemy. If Hitler is your enemy, anything is justified to defeat him, even to shorten the war, certainly to avoid losing. And that, I think, was the mood in which I lent myself to the building up of a nuclear deterrent, in the belief, by the way, that the Soviets were racing with their actual advantage in building ICBMs. They tested an ICBM some time before we were able to. And the idea that they would get the ability and use it to blackmail us or to attack us, and that was the desperate effort in which I was trying to help. In actual fact, at a time when we had some 40 ICBMs only, in 1961, the Russians had four, or one-tenth as many. We had several thousand bombers within range of Russia. The Russians had a couple hundred bombers within range of us. So that had been an illusory, totally illusory threat that I was working on. Just as the Manhattan Project scientists, many of whom became very strong anti-nuclear advocates and promoters later, found themselves working on producing the atom bomb in the belief that Germany was racing them to an atom bomb. It wasn't. That was a plausible belief, and in that belief, they created this weapon, which in the end may end us all.
Well, we're now in the range of North Korea, and one has to think of the analogy. I mean, on the one hand, there are people who are saying perhaps we have to attack them, take them out, do what we can before they hit us. By the same token, there's a great deal of concern that this could lead to terrible disaster.
People conjure up the notion of wouldn't it have been good to prevent a Russian weapon or a Chinese weapon or something else, and they've missed something here. North Korea does have nuclear weapons right now. We wish they didn't. Trump has said he's not going to recognize them as a nuclear state under any conditions, but actually they are a nuclear weapon state. And now we find ourselves, for the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 55 years ago, with our president making threats of attack, both non-nuclear or nuclear, against the nuclear weapon state, a state that can retaliate with nuclear weapons. That is a situation, I said, that hasn't occurred for half a century, and it's extremely dangerous. I would give anything in my life to avert or to lower the chances of war with North Korea right now.
What do you say to those conservatives? I just heard recently from one who say all they were doing under previous administrations was kicking the can down the road. Now Trump is talking tough and he's scaring them and we have more power and therefore maybe we can move something forward. Not necessarily denuclearize them, but Trump's maybe negotiating now, using that as a tool.
Well, what Trump says he's engaged in determinedly is denuclearizing them, is getting them to give up their nuclear weapons. The chance of that is
zero.
Yeah. You know, in a sense, nothing is zero. Miracles happen. But that's as close to zero as you can get. And threatening him, Kim Jong-un, with assassination, practicing it, preparing for it with special forces, rehearsing invasion of North Korea, as we do every year and as we've done last month, for example, is not the way to get them to give up their nuclear weapons, which they regard as their only deterrent to such a capability. Kim thinks it would be crazy to give up all of his nuclear weapons, and that's not the kind of crazy he is.
Well, I wonder, you know, it comes back to me, your book is plugged by Helen Caldicott. I know both knowing Helen for many years, but she talked about this nuclear arms race as being a kind of, men trying to have bigger sizes, like whether it's their hands or their buttons or whatever. It's mainly men who, of course, are in this race. I don't know if you give any credence to that, but it seems that way.
I think she's onto something. There is a gender aspect to this when it comes to militarism in general and to missiles very specifically. I think it's not purely rhetorical. I haven't heard any women yet talking about whether their button is larger than someone else's button. And that does seem to be a male aspect of that. As a matter of fact, when they chose the size of the MX missile, they were given Brzezinski was shown an array of missiles that might fit into a Minuteman silo, might be able to supplant the Minuteman. And he very clearly just chose the largest one. Let's have a larger one than they. They had a very large one, the SS-18, which was a mistake for them, too, as a matter of fact, a provocation to us. But this notion of we must have parity, even when the other side has a doomsday machine, then we should have a doomsday machine. Actually, that was a mistake the Russians made. Khrushchev didn't make it, but he was thrown out after the missile crisis, and Brezhnev came in and told the military, you can have what you want. And they wanted what the U.S. had, which was a doomsday machine. They wanted the ability to destroy life on Earth. There's really only two nations of the nine nuclear nations that can do a thorough job of that now, the U.S. and Russia. If there's a North Korean war, I would say, I expect testing to resume all over the world. Even if you knock North Korea out of it, India and Pakistan will acquire H-bombs, thermonuclear weapons, instead of the A-bombs, the fission weapons they now have, very quickly, within a year or two. Now, a war between India and Pakistan, we've known now for 10 years, alone, using 100, just 100 compared to the thousands we have, but 100 fission weapons would starve up to 2 billion people on Earth, about a third of the Earth's population. They really have no right to hold the world hostage to that over Kashmir. But if they get H-bombs, they will join the club of having full doomsday machines.
We're going to talk some more with Daniel Ellsberg, particularly find out maybe what can be done about these doomsday machines, or the doomsday machine, which is the title of his book, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And you can join us. Let me invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you. The number to call to join the program is 866-733-6786. We welcome your call, so please feel free to join us with any questions or comments. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. This is Forum. You're listening to us on KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Daniel Ellsberg, national security expert and former Pentagon analyst. He's with us talking about his new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And he'll appear at City Lights Books at 6:30 p.m. on February 1st. And he'll appear at City Lights Books then, and he'll appear at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley at 7:30 p.m. There's a movie out, and some of you probably know about it. It's a Steven Spielberg movie. It's called The Post. It's about the Pentagon Papers leak. Matthew Reese plays Daniel Ellsberg. I thought we'd hear a little bit of a scene of that where Matthew Reese playing Daniel Ellsberg is showing journalist Ben Bagdikian the leaked Pentagon Papers.
The study had 47 volumes. I slipped out a couple at a time. It took me months to copy it all.
What the hell?
Well, we were all former government guys. Top clearance, all of that. McNamara wanted academics to have the chance to examine what had happened. He would say to us, let the chips fall where they may.
Brave man.
Well, I think guilt was a bigger motivator than courage. McNamara didn't lie as well as the rest, but I don't think he saw what was coming, what we'd find. But it didn't take him long to figure out. Well, first of all, to figure out. If the public ever saw these papers, they would turn against the war.
Want to talk about the movie? Have you seen it, Dan?
Yes, I have seen it a couple of times. It's a very good movie.
Happy with the way you're portrayed?
Well, it's wonderful to be portrayed by a terrific actor who actually looks pretty much the way I did then, only better.
Modesty does become you. Is it accurate?
It's a dramatic movie, let's put it that way. But the general sense of it, what was going on, the war between the president and the press, and the decision by the press, and specifically by a woman, by the only woman publisher, to take a decision which had been taken earlier by the men of the New York Times, to give them credit. But this, I think, what takeaway from this movie, by the way, at this particular moment, will be the image of a woman who, truthfully, accurately, historically, really did stand up at great risk to her institution and to her own career and defy the president and move ahead.
In that sense,
it's a lot like the Me Too and the Time's Up movement, of which Meryl Streep is actually a part.
It's Meryl Streep playing Katharine Graham, and it's a movie for our time because it is a movie that, as I understand, I haven't seen it yet, but from everything I've read, really says things that need to be said about the positive role that journalism plays and ought to continue to play. I want to ask you, though, let's talk about, we'll get some callers and a lot of people want to talk to you and have questions or comments, but I want to get you to talk about dismantling this, because when we talk about denuclearizing North Korea, for example, we both said zero likelihood of that happening unless there's a miracle. And we see is advancing into more nuclear weapon armaments now, not only by Trump and the Trump administration, but by Putin.
That's right.
And, I mean, when you think about, for example, saying, all right, Russia and the United States should lead the pack here because there are other countries that could follow suit beyond those who are members of the nuclear club. What can really be done? I hear this constantly, by individual citizens. I mean, I hear that as a refrain almost.
Yeah. It depends where they are. Individual citizens do populate the Defense Department and the White House and the CIA. And I would say to any of those who have knowledge of the official estimates of what the human costs will be and the long-term costs to arms control and everything else of a war with Korea, I would wish they would consider right now as individuals at the possible or the really likely cost to their careers, even their freedom, sharing that information with the public. I would say to them, don't do what I did. Don't wait till the bombs are actually falling. Don't wait till thousands have died. If you have documents that might avert that catastrophe, put it out. So those are individuals.
This is a whistleblower.
Those are whistleblowers, and I wish we had them right now at the high level, and they could save a war's worth of lives, I would hope. As far as individual citizens, it's time for us to make ourselves heard the way, by the way, on a different issue. Women are for the first time breaking silence and speaking out, and the Me Too phenomenon I just described right now. Well, individual citizens should be heard finally waking up from this epoch of madness, essentially, of threatening to blow the world up in various circumstances.
What can galvanize that? I know the Me Too movement, I think, was galvanized a lot by Daniel Trump being charged by about 16 women and, you know, nobody bringing him to any kind of justice.
Well, that's true. My highest hope would be if this book will help contribute to waking people up from a kind of walking toward an abyss, sleepwalking as they've been doing, as if nuclear weapons had all, in fact, gone away. You were asking about what can happen.
I said Daniel Trump. Obviously, I meant Donald Trump. There may be some Freudian notion of Daniel in there. I don't get it.
Okay.
But please, go ahead.
The New York Times identified me once as Daniel J. Ellsberg. I don't know why. I hope it wasn't for the reason you just suggested here, the analogy. But the question arises of why we still have, for example, Minuteman missiles, land-based missiles, which are essentially nothing but lightning rods for attack from Russian forces. They're vulnerable to attack. Unless you use them, you lose them if there's warning that there's attack on the way. And as you mentioned, others like Eric Schlosser or Bruce Blair and Scott Sagan have written books showing how serious false alarms have occurred in the past, in 1979, 1980, 1995, after the Cold War. Yeltsin was looking at his briefcase as to whether to push the button, metaphorically here, and respond to what was, in fact, a weather rocket from Norway. This is my refrain. If any of these things had happened, if the warning had gone on a little bit longer, or in the case of crises, if one person on a Soviet submarine vessel, the Arkhipov, had not said no to the commander of the vessel who wanted to start a nuclear war at that moment, if Petrov in Russia had not said it's a false alarm when he got word on his satellite warning system that American missiles were on their way over, and he wasn't sure whether it was a false alarm or not. He chose to say that it was a false alarm against the advice of all of his colleagues in that unit. Had he done otherwise, or had they been in charge, I have to keep saying, civilization would have ceased to exist. That's the Kennedy called the sword of Damocles, you know, hanging over our heads by a thread. And it has been a threat. I think that when you know the example of the past false alarms and the readiness on both sides, a mad readiness on both sides, including Russia and including Kim, to get the first blow in with your faced with ambiguous warning that there might be a war coming. Actually, given nuclear winter, it really doesn't matter who gets the first blow in. Everybody's going to go anyway. But to make new weapons that target the others, nuclear weapons, that can get there fast and far and be fired very first, has profits and jobs and votes on both sides. Even in Russia, by the way, they now have a profit motive for building these things.
Yes.
They have their equivalent of Boeing and Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin, who are all competing, by the way, for new models of land-based missiles, which would be just as vulnerable, just as the current ones, just as totally unjustifiable part, but their jobs in Montana and Wyoming and North Dakota, manning these things. And I think manning is generally a pretty gendered word there. I don't know how many women there are down in the silos. But the idea of it, that we must have missiles as big and as many. Actually, it's not just rhetoric to say there is a male aspect to that as there is to war.
There's also a big money aspect to it, because more and more money now is being made in building more weapons, of course. But that's another story. We've got a lot of callers, and I want to get to as many of them as I can. I was just remembering, though, a conversation we had at a July 4th event, and you were bringing up, because you're talking about close calls, and you were bringing up to me that James Schlesinger, who was then Secretary of Defense,
yes,
talked Nixon out of what his ravings were in the evening, and talking about using weapons and so forth. But he took charge. I mean, and maybe somebody needs to take charge again. Let me get some callers on here, though. Let's go to Leif first. Leif, you're on.
Hi. So in the early 70s, I was a Army officer in a tank battalion in the 1st Infantry Division, and we were tasked with fighting the Russians should they invade in Europe. And so we practiced against, we call it the aggressor nation, but they were dressed as Russians and fought as Russians, endlessly. And every field problem ended with a line of simulated atomic bombs across the horizon. That's how it always ended. And we'd just throw everything in reverse and go as fast as we could in the opposite direction, knowing that we were toast.
By the way, where did the word to initiate those nuclear weapons supposedly come from in the exercise? How high up was that initiated? You wouldn't know, I suppose, but do you?
I wouldn't know. I was a lieutenant.
You know, there was an exercise exactly like that in 1983, as late as that, a few years before the Cold War ended. And it happened to be at a time when Andropov, in charge in Russia, former KGB head, was convinced that his counterpart, Reagan, was, first of all, crazy, he thought, and second, that was determined to launch a surprise attack on the Soviets. Now, in fact, Reagan was not at all thinking of that, but he was involved in a trillion, you know, this cold mine is just causing one malaprop after another, but he was building up weapons at the rate of $1 trillion over a long period. The biggest buildup since Kennedy, and the biggest ever since till now under Obama and Trump. So he was building up first strike weapons, including precise weapons to hit their ICBMs. He was carrying out provocative exercises against Russian air defenses, as we are doing against North Korean defenses right now. So the situation was amazingly similar to what is happening now and what you just said. The exercise you described, which goes toward nuclear weapons, was happening. It was called Able Archer. There's a very, very good book by Nathan Jones of the National Security Archive called Able Archer 83. And it was a war scare we didn't know was happening. Andropov was not only worried with these reasons, wrong reasons, but plausible reasons, that he was about to be struck first, but he was planning to respond to that possibility the same crazy way we would have, which is to preempt it, to strike first. Now, that's actually madness. He wasn't a clinical madman. He was just using the same plans we were, and he was getting ready to preempt a U.S. airstrike. And the example I just gave moments ago of Stanislav Petrov was just before that exercise in Able Archer, when the satellites actually said, there are American missiles on their way over to Russia, and he had to decide whether that was a false alarm or not. That took place, in other words, in a context where the other side was actually worried about a war about to start. That's the mood we're putting Kim Jong-un in right now. He would be crazy to initiate that war the way he's planned to do if there's an imminent war, to preempt it. That would be crazy. It would be suicidal for him, catastrophic for the world, just the way it would be for us to carry out similar plans.
We don't know how crazy he might be, though. That's the problem in part.
He wouldn't have to be crazier than our leaders, is what I'm saying, of the great powers. The problem is not really whether he's crazier than they are. The problem is he's not less crazy, and that's also true of Donald J. Trump.
Let me thank Lee for the call and get to another caller, and that's Mary. Mary, join us.
Yes. Well, my father was in the Navy. He was at the hydrogen bomb tests in the Bikini Islands during Operation Red Wing, and he is actually one of the few guys still alive from that mission because almost everybody died of cancer, and my dad did have cancerous experiences. He also experienced radiation poisoning. At the time, nobody seemed to be overly concerned with radiation, but this was actually when they were going on board the ship testing the men. And this also, by the way, was happening just before Vietnam. So they were out there blowing up islands and then letting natives move back on the islands, letting the men experience fallout and seeing what happens. And my main concern is that mutually assured destruction only works if both sides actually understand the ramifications of nuclear war. And my issue is I don't think Kim and I don't think Donald actually get that this would be it. I mean, I don't think Donald understands nuclear winter or radiation poisoning or any of it.
And he's not as strong in the sciences as Dan Ellsberg.
Well, I mean, it's almost like a blithe unconcern with any negative consequences of choices. And the fact that he wants to go in and increase the armaments and add to them and so forth is just, it seems to be beyond insane.
Well, Mary, I thank you for
totally
that call.
And
I appreciate hearing from you. I'm wondering, since we're talking about North Korea, what about your thoughts? President Trump has been scathing in his criticisms of the intelligence.
Who has? Of intelligence.
President Trump has been very critical, particularly because of Russia, I suppose, and what he keeps denying is collusion. But what about these miscalculations about North Korea's nuclear development program? I mean, they were underestimated by years.
That's true. That should not convey confidence as exactly what will happen if a war does occur. The fact that the intelligence has been wrong on this. One of the points, for example, going back to what we were talking about earlier, talk of decapitating the North Korean regime and thus paralyzing their response by assassinating Kim Jong-un or by hitting his command and control, which we're very open about. It had been part of our planning in general war forever, but very secretly. We're ignoring the fact that such talk under Carter and others, Brzezinski, Reagan, of decapitation led Russia to assure that that could not paralyze their response. They instituted what they called a dead hand or perimeter system, which would assure that if Moscow were destroyed, there would be retaliation on a large scale. From my own work over the years now on command and control, I feel pretty confident that Kim Jong-un has made similar arrangements, that it's not possible to paralyze his response and by killing him. On the contrary, and here's where human craziness among leaders comes in, he may very well contemplate the thought that if I get killed, I, Kim Jong-un, get killed, let the world go up. And there may be very little limit to what he has in mind in terms of throwing nuclear weapons around in China, even in China, and in, but his ally, to get an all-out cataclysmic war started. Certainly in Japan and South Korea, there would be virtual annihilation. And I believe that Senator Lindsey Graham is quite mistaken when he assures us, quote, vicious as this statement is, all the casualties will be over there. That's an exact quote. Thousands of dead, he said, he could have said millions, will be over there. They will not be over here. The fact is that Kim does not need an ICBM to get a weapon into San Francisco Harbor or Long Beach Harbor or L.A. All he needs is boats, and he has boats, with a container in them carrying one of the nuclear warheads that he does have.
He's already smuggling an immense amount through boats and ships and so forth. We know that.
Yeah, he could put him into a bale of marijuana. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, there's, I mean, a lot of weapons going, in fact, even out of North Korea to the Middle East, we know now. But a couple of questions about tactical weapons. Let me go to these. One is from Ernst. One is from Joseph. Ernst writes, what do generals consider to be a valid tactical use of a nuclear weapon? I cannot imagine a tactical use for a nuclear weapon that would not be better accomplished via conventional weapons. And Joseph says, so would Daniel Ellsberg deny battle group commanders the use of tactical nuclear weapons during battle? Would he also deny these commanders napalm or other effective technology? Where do you draw the line?
That's kind of dizzying because I have been... I was trained as a peacetime Marine. I was a company commander in the Marine Corps in peacetime, and I used that training in Vietnam to see a war there, a small war, quote, up quite close, and I have seen napalm used and white phosphorus. And I would have to say, as a matter of fact, as a Marine, I had misgivings about being defended by white phosphorus and napalm after I saw the effects of that on human bodies, and I was trained in other kinds of weapons. But coming back to tactical nuclear weapons, the chance of a tactical nuclear weapon war between nuclear weapon states, saying limited to tactical nuclear weapons, is as close to zero as something can get. Fortunately, as I say, miracles do happen. We're still here. That's a miracle. That's a miracle.
Yeah.
The Berlin Wall did come down. Nelson Mandela did become president of South Africa without a violent revolution. So absolutely unforeseeable, unimaginable events can take place. But in this case, that's what you're counting on, in effect. There's talk right now of giving North Korea a limited bloody nose, hitting them to show how determined we are with a nuclear weapon possibly, but in any case on their missile sites, so that they will back off. Yes, that could happen. It's just about as likely as, let's say, Exxon going out of business tomorrow because of their pollution of the atmosphere, or Kim Jong-un, let's say, stepping down in favor of a democratic regime. The idea that that would stay limited is crazy. And it's the kind of craziness, unfortunately, that's kind of normal in the last 70 years. It's a new norm of madness, and whether we'll escape the effects of that for another 70 years, I think, is very unlikely. It's got to change.
Well, can we get another disarmament movement going, do you think? Is there a possibility for that? Maybe we have to save ourselves, but you have, as you say, some pretty reckless and indeed dangerous leaders.
We're not going down different paths. It's not likely. In fact, it's very unlikely given the institutional pressures on both sides, on all sides. Not all the nuclear states are building up their nuclear forces. At the same time, as 120 nations that do not have nuclear weapons have called for an entire ban on that. So the question is, which movement here, these countervailing movements, is likely to succeed? Well, actually, destruction is more likely, much more likely, but it's not certain. Getting this movement to change this actual madness is, as I say, it's unlikely, but it's not impossible. And that's what I'm at, and that's what I'm hoping this book will contribute to.
And the book, again, is Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Here is Elizabeth. Elizabeth, join us, please.
Hi. Mr. Ellsberg, I'm simply calling to thank you for your role model about how to be a citizen in this country. And I'm speaking as a parent. I'm speaking as a person who really struggles with how to live with Trump as our president, and as a president about the kind of knowing sacrifice that has been made throughout the history of this country, whether it was women's suffrage, whether it was the abolition of slavery, and your example of the decisions that you made to, you know, I've heard that you knew full well that you would be facing prison time. And I think that that's a wonderful example, and it's really an example that we need right now.
Thank you for the call. I think I've had this conversation with you another time, but I know you're an admirer of Snowden's and of Chelsea Manning's,
yes.
Again, the whistleblowers and so forth. I had recent occasion to interview Snowden, and I thought to myself, I mean, you know, there are many people who admire him enormously, but I thought to myself, he didn't risk what you risk. You really believed you were going to go to prison for life, and there was every reason to believe that, because they were trying you under those conditions. Snowden, I think, early on knew he was going to flee the country.
I disagree with you, actually, that he his motives and his risk-taking and something was different. He knew that he had to be out of the country to explain what he was doing to the journalists over a period of months and years, as he has done, by the way, that what he was doing, unlike the Pentagon Papers, which are a history, they're a story, a narrative, speak for themselves, essentially. What he was putting out was a lot of information about that was hidden behind acronyms, behind, you know, inscrutable descriptions and euphemisms and all this sort of thing. Very technical. And he had to be in a position to tell journalists what they were looking at and what they should look for in that material, and let them make the decision, by the way, as to what was news and what ought to be.
Couldn't have done that here with Glenn Greenwald and company?
I'm sorry?
He couldn't have done that here with Glenn Greenwald.
He couldn't have done it here, because whereas I was able to speak freely at rallies, even to demonstrations, lectures, while I was on trial for 2 years, facing a 115-year possible prison sentence during that time, he wouldn't be free to speak to journalists for 1 hour. And he knew that from watching Chelsea Manning and also Tom Drake and others from National Security Agency, who were simply gagged, essentially. He knew if he came back to this country, I think that Ed Snowden would be incommunicado for the rest of his life. We would hear nothing from him. He's learned that from Chelsea Manning, who spent 10.5 months in solitary, then 7 years in prison. And it's only now, after those 7 years, that any reporter has been able to speak to Chelsea Manning. It was not possible for that 7 years. So I think it was essential. He learned that lesson. And he learned from them. He gives them credit for it, too. For their example, they paid a big price, that he had to be out of the country. But being out of the country doesn't mean you're out of the reach of U.S. special forces, actually. And the kind of ability that President Obama claimed, the ability to eliminate Anwar al-Awlaki, for example, with a drone, or his son, for some reason, weeks later. I think he was in great physical danger until he got into Russia.
He'd rather
be out of Russia right now, somewhere else, but he's probably safer there than otherwise.
Yeah, he told me he would rather be out of Russia, clearly. I think about, a listener wants to know, I wonder if Ellsberg supports the Iranian nuclear treaty?
Oh, absolutely. I think that was a real achievement. As a matter of fact, I didn't expect a whole lot from President Barack Obama that I supported very strongly twice, but I did hope he was less likely to get us into war with Iran than his rivals, especially the Republican. And I felt good about that when he got the treaty, and I think nearly everyone agrees. It's very, very ominous that President Trump is talking about rescinding that treaty and possibly going to war with Iran. That will be even worse in many ways than we saw with Iraq.
Well, just a news bulletin, the EU today is actually urging the United States to stay in the Iran. The European Union is urging.
Yeah, well, the whole world is almost. Donald Trump is very isolated on that.
Another listener wants to know, has Ellsberg seen the Danish documentary The Man Who Saved the World about the man who refused to act during the 1983 Soviet nuclear false alarm incident? Do you know that?
Yes, I do. You say Danish? I thought it was something else, BBC or something. You know, I've mentioned two men, both, who each had a documentary named after them called The Man Who Saved the World. And they both deserved it. Vasily Arkhipov in the Cuban Missile Crisis, who vetoed the use of a nuclear torpedo. And Stanislav Petrov had the same title used. And it's both true. When I say the situation is mad, it's a mad situation that the survival of the world, and that's not a rhetorical overstatement, should depend upon the judgment of a single prudent person in the chain of command who's basically going against the advice of his colleagues and against what other people would have done in his situation. That's how close we've come, and that's mad. As I quote in the epigraph to the book, I think it deserves real thought, by Nietzsche, which is, madness in individuals is something exceptional, but in groups, nations, parties, and epochs, it is the norm. Well, we've been seeing that norm in the last 70 years, but it has the potential for near extinction that did not exist before.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there with the Nietzsche quote and near extinction. Dan Ellsberg, always good to see you. Thank you for being with us. And Dan Ellsberg will be at the Mechanic Institute 6:30 on the 18th and February 1st. He's appearing at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley at 7:30 p.m. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 in the evening. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Jeremy Siegel, Tina Larberg, Katie Springer, and Penny Nelson. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Howard Gelman this morning. And our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Devin Holt and Amanda Font. Intern is Patrick Fitzgerald. Managing editor, Ethan Lindsay. Executive producer, Holly Kernan. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. And for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.